The Launch, October 1988. Jobs had perfected the art of turning product launches into theatrical productions, and for the world premiere of The Next Computer on October 12, 1988, in San Francisco's Symphony Hall, he wanted to outdo himself. He needed to blow away the doubters. In the weeks leading up to the event, he drove up to San Francisco almost every day to hole up in the Victorian house of Susan Kerr, Next graphic designer, who had done the original fonts and icons for the Macintosh. She helped prepare each of the slides as Jobs fretted over everything from the wording to the right hue of green to serve as the background color. "I like that green," he said proudly as they were doing a trial run in front of some staffers. Great green," they all murmured in assent. No detail was too small. Jobs went over the invitation list and even the lunch menu: mineral water, croissants, cream cheese, bean sprouts. He picked out a video projection company and paid it $60,000 for help. And he hired the postmodernist theater producer George Coates to stage the show. Coates and Jobs decided, not surprisingly, on an austere and radically simple stage look. The unveiling of the black, perfect cube would occur on a starkly minimalist stage setting with a black background, a table covered by a black cloth, a black veil draped over the computer, and a simple vase of flowers. Because neither the hardware nor the operating system was actually ready, Jobs was urged to do a simulation, but he refused. Knowing it would be like walking a tightrope without a net, he decided to do the demonstration live. More than 3,000 people showed up at the event, lining up 2 hours before curtain time. They were not disappointed, at least by the show. Jobs was on stage for 3 hours, and he again proved to be, in the words of Andrew Pollock of the New York Times, the Andrew Lloyd Webber of product introductions, a master of stage flair and special effects. Wes Smith of the Chicago Tribune said the launch was to product demonstrations what Vatican II was to church meetings. Jobs had the audience cheering from his opening line, "It's great to be back." He began by recounting the history of personal computer architecture, and he promised that they would now witness an event that occurs only once or twice in a decade, a time when a new architecture is rolled out that is going to change the face of computing. The next software and hardware were designed, he said, after 3 years of consulting with universities across the country. What we realized was that higher ed wants a personal mainframe. As usual, there were superlatives. The product was incredible, he said, the best thing we could have imagined. He praised the beauty of even the parts unseen, balancing on his fingertips the foot square circuit board that would be nestled in the foot cube box. He enthused, "I hope you get a chance to look at this a little later. It's the most beautiful printed circuit board I've ever seen in my life." He then showed how the computer could play speeches. He featured King's "I Have a Dream" and Kennedy's "Ask Not," and send email with audio attachments. He leaned into the microphone on the computer to record one of his own. "Hi, this is Steve, sending a message on a pretty historic day." Then he asked the audience to add a round of applause to the message, and they did. One of Jobs's management philosophies was that it is crucial every now and then to roll the dice and bet the company on some new idea or technology. At the next launch, he boasted of an example that, as it turned out, would not be a wise gamble. Having a high-capacity but slow optical read-write disk and no floppy disk as a backup. 2 years ago, we made a decision, he said. We saw some new technology, and we made a decision to risk our company. Then he turned to a feature that would prove more prescient. What we've done is made the first real digital books, he said, noting the inclusion of the Oxford edition of Shakespeare and other tomes. There has not been an advancement in the state of the art of printed book technology since Gutenberg. At times, he could be amusingly aware of his own foibles, and he used the electronic book demonstration to poke fun at himself. A word that's sometimes used to describe me is mercurial, he said, then paused. The audience laughed knowingly, especially those in the front rows, which were filled with Next employees and former members of the Macintosh team. Then he pulled up the word in the computer's dictionary and read the first definition: of or relating to or born under the planet Mercury. Scrolling down, he said, I think the third one is the one they mean, characterized by unpredictable changeableness of mood. There was a bit more laughter. If we scroll down the thesaurus, though, we see that the antonym is Saturnine. Well, what's that? By simply double-clicking on it, we immediately look that up in the dictionary, and here it is. Cold and steady in moods, slow to act or change, of a gloomy or surly disposition. A little smile came across his face as he waited for the ripple of laughter. Well, he concluded, I don't think mercurial is so bad after all. After the applause, he used the quotations book to make a more subtle point about his reality distortion field. The quote he chose was from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. After Alice laments that no matter how hard she tries, she can't believe impossible things, the White Queen retorts, Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Especially from the front rows, there was a roar of knowing laughter. All of the good cheer served to sugarcoat or distract attention from the bad news. When it came time to announce the price of the new machine, Jobs did what he would often do in product demonstrations, reel off the features, describe them as being worth thousands and thousands of dollars, and get the audience to imagine how expensive it really should be. Then he announced what he hoped would seem like a low price. We're going to be charging higher education a single price of $6,500. From the faithful, there was scattered applause. But his panel of academic advisors had long pushed to keep the price between $2,000 and $3,000, and they thought that Jobs had promised to do so. Some of them were appalled. This was especially true once they discovered that the optional printer would cost another $2,000, and the slowness of the optical disc would make the purchase of a $2,500 external hard disk advisable. There was another disappointment that he tried to downplay. Early next year, we will have our 0.9 release, which is for software developers and aggressive end users. There was a bit of nervous laughter. What he was saying was that the real release of the machine and its software, known as the 1.0 release, would not actually be happening in early 1989. In fact, he didn't set a hard date. He merely suggested it would be sometime in the second quarter of that year. At the first Next retreat back in late 1985, he had refused to budge, despite Joanna Hoffman's pushback, from his commitment to have the machine finished in early 1987. Now it was clear it would be more than 2 years later. The event ended on a more upbeat note, literally. Jobs brought on stage a violinist from the San Francisco Symphony who played Bach's A minor violin concerto in a duet with the Next computer on stage. People erupted in jubilant applause. The price and the delayed release were forgotten in the frenzy. When one reporter asked him immediately afterward why the machine was going to be so late, Jobs replied, It's not late. It's 5 years ahead of its time. As would become his standard practice, Jobs offered to provide exclusive interviews to anointed publications in return for their promising to put the story on the cover. This time he went one exclusive too far, though it didn't really hurt. he agreed to a request from Business Week's Katie Hafner for exclusive access to him before the launch. But he also made a similar deal with Newsweek and then with Fortune. What he didn't consider was that one of Fortune's top editors, Susan Fraker, was married to Newsweek's editor, Maynard Parker. At the Fortune Story Conference, when they were talking excitedly about their exclusive, Fraker mentioned that she happened to know that Newsweek had also been promised an exclusive, and it would be coming out a few days before Fortune's. So Jobs ended up that week on only two magazine covers. Newsweek used the cover line, "Mr. Chips," and showed him leaning on a beautiful Next, which it proclaimed to be the most exciting machine in years. Businessweek showed him looking angelic in a dark suit, fingertips pressed together like a preacher or professor. But Hafner pointedly reported on the manipulation that surrounded her exclusive. Next carefully parceled out interviews with its staff and suppliers, monitoring them with a censor's eye, she wrote. That strategy worked, but at a price. Such maneuvering, self-serving, and relentless, displayed the side of Steve Jobs that so hurt him at Apple. The trait that most stands out is Jobs' need to control events. When the hype died down, the reaction to the Next computer was muted, especially since it was not yet commercially available. Bill Joy, the brilliant and wry chief scientist at rival Sun Microsystems, called it the first yuppie workstation, which was not an unalloyed compliment. Bill Gates, as might be expected, continued to be publicly dismissive. "Frankly, I'm disappointed," he told the Wall Street Journal. "Back in 1981, we were truly excited by the Macintosh when Steve showed it to us, because when you put it side by side with another computer, it was unlike anything anybody had ever seen before. The Next machine was not like that. In the grand scope of things, most of these features are truly trivial." He said that Microsoft would continue its plans not to write software for the Next. Right after the announcement event, Gates wrote a parody email to his staff. "All reality has been completely suspended," it began. Looking back at it, Gates laughs that it may have been the best email I ever wrote. When the Next computer finally went on sale in mid-1989, the factory was primed to churn out 10,000 units a month. As it turned out, sales were about 400 a month. The beautiful factory robots, so nicely painted, remained mostly idle, and Next continued to hemorrhage cash.